Excellent. An ale for me. And for my officers. In fact, ales for everyone.
Oh. Turn backwards. Rick and work. And Will.
Oh, yes.
Hello and welcome to another episode of Ten Backward with myself, Will Turland, this man, Rick Everson.
Hello.
And this man, Rick Palmer.
Hello.
This episode we're going to be discussing the pilot episode of Star Trek The Next Generation, Encounter at Farpoint. Why are we doing this? Why are we going back 30 years when there's new Star Trek out that we could be talking about?
You say it's 30 years.
30 years the week that we're recording this.
Wait a minute.
Therefore, it constitutes some sort of anniversary, I believe.
That, you know, that would be a great reason to record a podcast about Encounter at Farpoint.
Sounds like a good idea. Let's do that.
Yes.
Okay.
Next Generation's partied through its 20s. It's 30 now. It's got a more of a grown-up view of the world.
Yeah.
Sees the world for what it is.
Get a
mortgage. Time to settle down.
Where should we start?
Well, I was thinking that I know that there was essentially the idea for a TV series came about 1986, I think. There'd been four movies so far. No, five. Have there been five? No, four.
I think three, and four was in production around the same time.
Yeah, and I think essentially those films were really successful. Paramount wanted to make as much Star Trek stuff as they could at the time, but the main stars, the familiar stars, were like Shatner and Nimoy. They were on pretty good contracts, and there was no way you were going to get them back into TV. Mm-mm. So that meant making a new TV series.
Yes, because that way you can keep getting some of that sweet, sweet Star Trek money while not paying the actors nearly as much. I'm a cynical view, but yeah, I think the studio view was there's money to be made off this. We've had three successful films.
Yeah, and there'd been potential Star Trek projects between original series and Next Gen, hadn't there?
As early as 1973, there was the potential for a Star Trek movie, but Gene Roddenberry he screwed it up. He asked for too much money in terms of being involved with it, and Paramount nixed the project. And then in the 70s, there was also the animated series.
Didn't they move into the Phase 2 project?
I was going to say...
Yeah, Phase 2 was about 1977, I think.
Yeah.
Right.
Well, Paramount wanted to start their own TV network, didn't they?
Yeah.
They got a really long way into making Phase 2, and then...
Sets were built, and stories had been written.
Ships designed, everything. Models, I think, as well.
Yeah. I think the common belief is then Star Wars happened, and they said, and the studios went, "No, we need a movie!" So, and then I think also the Paramount Network plan dropped through anyway.
Yeah, I think that was it, yeah.
Ironically, I think several years later, Paramount did launch their own network, and Star Trek Voyager was the flagship show. So, sort of a crazy poetic circle thing there.
Yeah, so I guess Next Gen was the first TV series that came out of an era of nearlies.
Yes,
in terms of TV series wise, in terms of bringing back the TV show, which had kind of always been on the cards ever since the original series was cancelled. I think fans were always obviously going to be open to the idea, but it was in 1986 that they announced it, and 1987 that it was made and released.
I think when it was announced, though, fans were actually fairly anti the idea. There was quite a vocal fan movement that did not want a new cast, a new ship, new characters.
Wait a minute, I can't believe that Star Trek fans have been moaning about a new Star Trek series. That doesn't seem like anything that would happen.
They wouldn't be moaning about it looking different or anything.
Exactly.
The ship being different or a time period.
It's been often cited that with the appearance of Discovery, the complaints that are coming up are just the same complaints we had 30 years ago.
Yeah.
And, well, things turned out okay then.
Yeah, they really did.
Point.
Absolutely. I mean, when I make my cynical comments about Paramount milking Star Trek for more money with a new series, I'm glad they did.
You were the teat they were milking, Rick.
Absolutely.
You produced so much for them.
Although, ironically, I wasn't already a fan that they were targeting. Next Generation is what got me into it.
Yeah. Me too, I guess. So when
it's kind of a weird thing, actually, because everyone's like, "Oh, it's 30 years," like, "Oh, wow, 30 years of Star Trek," and I think, "Well, actually, no, it's 27." Because we were about 3 years behind getting it.
It's exactly what I was going to ask you, because I have a memory of watching, when I re-watching Counter at Farpoint, I had a little flashback to being at my auntie's house, and my auntie had Sky. Mm. And I think maybe I saw it before BBC got it.
BBC had it first.
Oh.
And I think it was only when it got popular there that Sky was like, I'll have that.
Right, I've 100% misremembered that then.
But yeah, it must have been about 1990. BBC launched it, the old Wednesday night, 6 o'clock, BBC Two thing. Yeah, it was a successful show for BBC Two, and it was a big thing for the time slot. It was a key moment.
Yeah,
those Wednesday nights were pretty damn special.
Yeah, definitely. Well, I mean, once you got to around season three of Next Gen, I was 100%
kicked into high gear, didn't it?
I wouldn't say in the early seasons I enjoyed it, but I didn't watch it religiously.
What I am relieved about, because BBC got screened up to series 3 and then Sky outbid them and got the rights to show the rest of it, what I'm glad is that BBC was still able to negotiate at least getting Best of Both Worlds part 2, because if you don't have Sky, you're watching BBC, you get to Best of Both Worlds part 1, oh, that's it, no more on BBC, Sky have got it now.
this is our generation's World War Two, I think.
Yeah.
Yeah, you young'uns don't know what it was like when you had to wait months for the next TV show to be
really
on.
They don't. I mean, you know, with the luxury of Discovery being on Netflix, I mean, to be fair, you're still having to wait a week between episodes, but...
I've seen interviews with people in America who remember distinctly that summer between Best of Both Worlds Part 1 and Part 2, and what a nightmare it was. I'm like... Okay, fair enough, I only had to wait a week. Admittedly, you had to wait 3 years after you guys to watch any Star Trek Next Generation.
Yeah.
But at least I only had a week between Best of Both Worlds Part 1 and 2.
Yeah.
Because some people seem pretty sad by it. I think I've seen Patrick Stewart relate a story where people stopped him in the street and yelled at him, "You've ruined our summer!"
So going back to Encounter at Farpoint... Rick, remind me, who was the we were talking about the writing process of it, because there's a good documentary on Netflix actually about the making of Next Gen.
So it was DC Fontana that was hired by Paramount to write the script, but from what I've read, she was pretty stymied by they couldn't agree immediately how long they wanted it to be. So Paramount wanted it to be 2 hours long, I think, and Gene Roddenberry wanted it to be an hour long, and also all through the process, I think there was never really any consensus, and so it was hard to kind of to really get that script down into like a finely honed piece of writing.
Didn't Fontana write what was essentially an hour program?
Yes. So I think she had her idea, and then I think she wrote what she had. Yeah, she started writing an idea. Her impression was that it was going to be the shorter time period, and then, but it was always kind of like maybe back to 2 hours, an hour and a half. And so Gene Roddenberry kind of did some writing as well, and that his parts were mainly the kind of Q story and the cameo by Dr. McCoy.
I was going to ask, to my memory from having read about it, didn't Roddenberry write the Q part while Fontana had written the Farpoint mystery?
Yes, essentially. Yeah. So characters like Riker and Data, Dr. Crusher, I think, were in the Farpoint part. Mm. Yeah, were in there.
That's in keeping with with some of the interviews in the documentary that I've seen on Netflix. And there seems to be a little bit of bad blood from DC Fontana around the Gene Roddenberry rewrites in the.
Well, it affected the amount of money that she got, I think. When he's rewriting, it means that he'll get some money for doing that part of the script that DC Fontana wouldn't get.
Yeah.
So essentially she was getting paid for an hour script, even though it ended up turning into... And rather than let her do the rewrite up to the 2 hours,
yeah.
He kind of stole that other hour.
It was him, and he had a lawyer as well who did a lot of his negotiating to Paramount.
I think the documentary you're talking about is that Chaos on the Bridge.
Yes, it is.
That talks about that lawyer particularly quite a lot.
Yeah, it sounds like a real piece of work.
It does. I mean, there's a lot of stories coming from that era. It had a very, very, from what I can understand, what I gather, there was a lot of behind the scenes bad stuff went on. And at Destination Star Trek last year, Gates McFadden did talk a little bit about her firing from series one. And it touched upon some of the elements of the a particular producer who didn't take kindly to her having an opinion about her role and about her stories, and ended up like literally getting her fired. By the end of series two, that producer is also gone, and they could get her back. But it's like, then you see people like David Gerrold, known for Trouble with Tribbles. He left under a cloud because of goings on, and that lawyer's name always keeps coming up. I don't remember it offhand, but yeah, I mean, the documentary is quite interesting. It's worth a look.
Definitely. I enjoyed it. It's weirdly presented as if William Shatner's made it. But from watching it, I don't get that impression.
You mean literally made it? Made it in the...
No. I mean, he's done well for himself.
I've made it in Hollywood. I'm going to write myself a documentary on Netflix.
But it's like he's conceived of the idea and put it all together himself. It's almost as if he's like, he's done all the editing and stuff. But it felt to me like he was just there to do the voiceover.
Again, it was at Destination Star Trek last year. Greg Grunberg was moderating the Next Gen panel, which had Will Wheaton, Gates McFadden and Marina Sirtis on it. And he mentioned Chaos on the Bridge, and he was really raving about how great it was. And Marina Sirtis says, well, who's made this? And he said, oh, William Shatner's made it. And she's like, what the fuck does he know about our first year on TV? And then I think she's pretty much ended it like, well, I'm not going to watch it. Like that guy needs any of my money.
Brilliant.
Because Marina Sirtis is brilliant to talk to. She's so she's so funny. She's nothing like Troy. It's really surprising to actually hear her speak.
Oh, cool.
We are diverting a little bit off topic.
But it's good background for Encounter at Farpoint. But I guess we kind of want to look at it. We want to look at the show. I guess, you know, without thinking too much about the background and what's got into it, what do we think of it when we came to it 30 years later? I mean, first of all, I don't know if I've actually watched it since I very first saw it 27 years ago.
I can't remember when I last fully watched it. I'm sure I did, but I don't really have the memory of that, where I was or anything.
I think I've maybe watched it a few more times. I remember trying to show it to my wife one time.
Oh.
She wasn't overly impressed.
But you're still together, so...
Yes, yeah. That sounds like
something else you're talking about.
And when I got my Series 1 Blu-ray, I did watch it again then, because I particularly wanted to see it with all the... remastered shots in it, and it looks great.
It does, yeah.
And then most recently, I watched it last weekend in preparation for this very podcast.
Yeah,
yeah. It does look good. I was really impressed. With
I mean, looking down my notes, literally the first thing I talk about is the opening shot of the Enterprise, which is absolutely beautiful.
It's
a slow pan up, but I think the effects just really look amazing.
Yeah.
I know they were so lucky, apparently, that they got ILM to do these for the pilot, and they built a fairly big library of stock shots at the same time to keep using. But because ILM had done Wrath of Khan and Search for Spock as well, they'd established a fairly distinctive style for Star Trek. And I think because then they do this pilot, they keep in that style.
Yeah.
And because it's ILM, you know, they literally were at that point easily the best effects house in the business. So they did effects back in the 80s that I think hold up now. In terms of model work, it's absolutely beautiful. Mm.
And think about other shows that were on TV at that time. You wouldn't have seen special effects like that on a television show.
No, it was incredible.
On anything.
I mean, the funny thing, literally this was, Next Generation was my very first Star Trek. And I kind of like, it's difficult to think what in 1987 a fan would have made of this, because I don't have that frame of reference.
Yeah.
You know, I had no idea what any of it was. For the first two or three weeks of watching it, my naive young child mind assumed that the deflector dish of the Enterprise was in fact the view screen window everyone's looking out of. So my sense of scale is completely off.
Oh my god.
I know.
Well, I hope you're thoroughly ashamed of yourself. And after that great opening effect shot, then we go into a really cool shot when we're introduced to Picard, and he's kind of in shadow, he sort of steps out of shadow into the light. It's a really moody, cool shot, and he looks dead serious.
He times it really well, because he moves into the light just at the time the camera pulls in on him.
It's as if he knew.
Yeah, like, how did Captain Picard know that was going to happen?
Yeah,
it's great.
But it's a really stylish opening, actually.
It is. And then follow that with, he's got his log entry, and they sort of basically follow parts of the ship around. So you get your look at engineering and the bridge and everything, and it all looks quite nice. Well, you might know better than I. Are they using some sort of handheld Steadicam type thing as they're doing that?
They look to be, and
it's quite distinctive. I thought that was quite.
I don't remember seeing that used generally in the series as a whole, but there was some handheld stuff I noticed in engineering. And then there's a bit of handheld in, like, during the Q trial. They bring the handheld camera out again, and that's a bit unusual. Didn't tend to get that much in TV back in those days. I mean, these days it's all the rage to have a bit of shaky cam going.
NYPD Blue was the show that really introduced it, wasn't it?
Right. Remember that? And then kind of in sci-fi, I guess Battlestar. Well, and Firefly to some extent did that. So they kind of had a bit of shaky cam with their, like, with the effect sequences as well.
Well, yes, Firefly had a very distinctive way of doing that. It's really interesting. I was just thinking as well, that opening shot where you sort of pan up to the Enterprise and essentially go into the window. I know they didn't achieve that as a full shot, because this one night is open.
Yeah.
But with that and the log entry combined, I think, is that something that Discovery was emulating in the early start after the credits? Because they have Burnham's log entry, and they literally pan across the ship and go into the window to see her. Sadly, they didn't do the cool stepping out of shadow thing, but...
Maybe that's
It's literally just occurred to me as we were discussing it.
Ah.
So in terms of the pilot, I think... I get the impression, and I think it was something that there were things that they wanted to do to distinguish it from the original series. I think that, for instance, there was a bit of a veto on having a Vulcan character as a main character in the show.
Yeah.
But you see a Vulcan in the engine room, I think.
Yes, there is. I distinctly remember seeing one. Because actually, you don't often see alien background characters.
Mm.
So having a Vulcan background guy, that was sort of, was a little bit of striking in Next Gen, because you rarely see non-humans as backgrounds.
Is that partly a budget thing?
I think it's entirely a budget thing.
Right.
I think why they're going to have a guy sat in the makeup chair for 2-3 hours... spend all the makeup money if he's literally going to be in there for 3 seconds and do nothing.
The exact opposite of what they did in the films. In the slow motion picture, all the extras all the extras got everything.
I think that again, that's a sign of the Star Wars influence, because Star Wars packs so many crazy looking aliens into backgrounds.
Yes.
So I think, like, that scene in motion picture where they've all gathered on the deck to see the videos.
Yeah, definitely.
There's loads of interesting alien species scattered around that crowd. It looks amazing.
But weirdly, Star Wars costs a lot less to make because of the way George Lucas made that film.
Mm.
Like, he did it. He did lots of. He just made it like a kind of. It was very fast paced, and so there were every so often you would notice like a slight mistake in the footage, but it doesn't matter because the film's going along at such a quick rate.
Mm. And speaking of fast paced, bloody hell, doesn't Encounter a Farpoint move? When you think about the first few minutes, you literally go, you go from Picard's log, conversation on the bridge, bam, weird energy barrier, Q appears, freezes guy, then suddenly we're in a massive, like, space chase.
Yeah.
We're separating the sorcerer at high warp, and we've met the captain, a robot, a Klingon, a telepath, a godlike being, flown at speeds unimaginable to any man, and split the ship in two.
Yeah.
It's literally like,
It's like 15 minutes. It's not even the first ad break.
It's literally, it flies.
Yeah.
Hugh's freeze powers are something we don't see ever again, I believe.
Yeah, I think he tries that a couple of times, then he's like, bored of that.
There's a great bit where that lieutenant gets frozen, and then Troy goes,
"He's frozen."
Oh, thanks, Troy. It's like setting a character up as she means to go on, stating the bleeding up.
And there's a nice bit later on where Worf says, "Sick Bay reports that Torres is feeling a bit better."
Yeah, that's nice. There's a weird bit in that very first bridge scene when we're introduced to Data, and I guess this is a way to tell us that Data is a robot, but there's a bit where Picard says that they're going to snoop on Farpoint Station, and Data doesn't understand snoop, the word snoop, and Picard kind of says,
"Data, how can you be programmed as a virtual encyclopedia of human information without knowing a simple word like snoop?"
And I found myself thinking, that is a really good point. That makes no sense. How would he not understand the word snoop? And his reasoning is, I think he said, well, maybe it's because I've not been programmed, because he eventually gets the word snoop explained to him. He says,
"Possibility. A kind of human behaviour I was not designed to emulate."
But it's like, well...
But then he knows other slang for it, doesn't he? Like other...
And I don't... I mean, I've not been brought up to commit genocide, but I know what the word is. And, you know, it's like you...
It's funny you picked that word.
Yeah. Yeah, I know.
Almost like you're trying to throw us off the scent.
I'm not going to commit genocide. Or am I?
That's exactly what someone who was going to commit genocide would say.
Had they fleshed out the Data character that much at that point?
Cause I've read
in that there are books where Data is actually the creation of aliens rather than a human.
Yes, yeah, initially. I mean, it wasn't too long in before they did start to establish the things that it was a human scientist. And obviously, I think when we meet Lore, which is early in series, somewhere in series one.
Is it Data Lore?
Yes.
Yeah.
But yeah, I think at one point that was a consideration of the character, that he'd been built by aliens.
Because Gene Roddenberry did a series about an android, or a short-lived series called The Questa Tapes.
He did.
And that's about an android that's created by aliens.
On the search for his maker, I believe.
Mm.
Yeah.
But yeah, I mean, I guess it's fair to say a lot of the characters are kind of finding their feet.
Absolutely. Yes.
In the opening scene, definitely. The opening scene with them on the bridge and their dialogue, it's a bit static.
Right, it's odd, isn't it?
There is a little bit of movement, though, because when he starts talking about Snoop, Data pushes his console out and gets up and stands up.
It's like a bit
aggressive.
Yeah, like, sit down, Commander.
Have you ever noticed that people just use different words for things? Data, stop doing a bit.
I'm glad they discontinued the idea of any time someone at the front consoles wanted to talk to the captain, they had to get up and turn around. Yeah. Which just would have been annoying.
I guess we don't get that shot very often from sort of Picard's point of view.
No.
Do we? I mean, we're mostly around the other way, looking at the bridge set. So
But yeah, it's all of it was finding their feet. I mean, when you look at Picard's character through it, he's grumpy.
He is, by and large,
grumpy for 95% of that story.
Mm.
He's weird. He's not particularly likable in the pilot episode,
no.
I don't think.
No,
that's
actually
a really weird moment.
Yeah.
Yes.
But should we...
He definitely gets... It's around the point when Riker joins the ship.
Yeah.
So when they meet Q, and they essentially kind of bargain with him and say, "Well, we're going to do this. We're going to go to this base and check it out and see if we can use it for trading from. So how about you see how we do with these guys and judge humanity that way?" Q's "Okay."
should we talk about the Q stuff first, and then should we get to the... Yeah, should we try and approach it in a sort of chronological order? Because actually, there's a lot to talk about in the whole Q trial and the whole introduction of Q. Because that's a whole big part of it.
I mean, that Q Q's appearance here sets quite a lot of stuff up. It establishes World War III, it establishes post-atomic horror. It's pretty grim stuff in a lot of it. It's
like, yeah, with a weird kind of... He likes dressing up.
He does, yes.
So he starts off as like a... Is he Napoleonic era kind of soldier?
I think so, yeah.
He's talking kind of like old English almost, isn't he?
Well, there's massive echoes of Trelane.
Yeah, that's what I was thinking. Very similar, actually. Yeah. And then he's, say, like a 60s era American soldier.
Yeah, and he does a bit of a kind
of...
Since
we've got to go after... He kind of tries to... Accent. He talks to Picard about going back to take on the commies something.
Yeah.
And then he appears as a soldier from World War III.
And
he... I would say his character's actually pretty consistent. Unlike the other members of the main cast, I think Q's pretty consistent right from the beginning.
I find in watching Encounter at Farpoint, this is Q as quite dangerous and threatening.
Yeah.
This is a Q that I am genuinely fearful of, as opposed to this is Q, the annoyance, the clown, which is how he maybe comes across in a lot of other episodes.
The spoil kind of bored. Like the prophet, what's they called? The prodigal son kind of character, who's a,
But I guess the first time you encounter someone like, I guess it's right that he is more of a threat.
Yes,
and it's when they get used to him a bit, and they kind of soften to. Well, I mean, I think I don't know if Picard ever really softens to him; just kind of tolerates him a bit more.
He doesn't have a lot of choice but to tolerate him. There's not a great deal they can do about him.
No. But John Delancey's great in the fight. He brings some real energy.
He does, absolutely.
I'd say the Q stuff's maybe some of the best stuff.
Oh, absolutely.
The actual encounter at Farpoint is a bit of a damp squib.
It would be a normal. It would be good as an episode of the series, but not a pilot episode.
I'd agree with that. It's a perfectly fine story. It's just not.
It's a very sort of Star Trek type mystery. But yeah, as an opening to this brand new series, I think it doesn't really. I think without the Q thing, without the Q storyline, it would have been in trouble, I think.
I was going to say there's some odd. The whole Q trial itself is quite odd. It reminded me a lot of a couple of the later episodes of the Prisoner, which is a 60s TV show. You may have heard of it. It's known in popular culture. But that show ended with a big, really weird trial, and it was incredibly surreal. It's a really odd ending for that series. Patrick McGoohan kind of came up with this ending that made absolutely no sense. But the last episode is all a big trial, and it's very much like the Q trial.
Actually, I did notice that Q starts appearing from a long way away.
Yes. Yeah,
I thought maybe like if they were doing it comedically, that scene would last. Weirdly, considering that they needed to fill out Encounter at Farpoint with the manual docking scene, I could have just gone, how about we have Q appear from miles away and we just have a scene where he slowly appears.
Approaches for five, and then
like
we just
5 minutes.
We keep cutting to shots of dwarves angry in the crowd.
What always gets me about Q coming into the court there is once you've seen All Good Things, they clearly had a massive upgrade in floating judge chair technology. Because he's shaking around, it looks really juddery.
Yeah.
Like, oh, he's going to fall off any second. Whereas in All Good Things, smooth glide, side to side, up and down, all over the place.
Yeah.
So.
Well, maybe he just wasn't quite in tune with his powers in those days.
Yeah.
Who knows?
He might have just been drunk.
Yeah. But there's some great acting that goes on in that scene. Like, everyone's really going for it.
And Denise Crosby.
Yes, yeah.
Denise Crosby, goodness, yeah.
Perhaps it's fair to say she overacts a little. But I didn't find myself kind of annoyed by that. I kind of liked it that at least the actors were absolutely going for it.
I think what the problem is, she is obviously playing that based on her perception of Yar's backstory and Yar's character. And from there and through to Yar's death in Skin of Evil, we got no episode that really gave us any clue of Yar's character or backstory. She was disservice in terms of building
the
her character.
The episode that does do that is done a while after with her sister.
Yeah.
Because you get a little hint. There's a bit of dialogue around how she, something about how she grew up in a world that was kind of a bit like the. I didn't quite get what she was referring to, but it's
what they mentioned.
I grew up on a world that allowed things like this court to happen.
That's it. Yeah.
And we see in Legacy when we see his sister, how bad that colony's got, and how it's just literally anarchy, chaos, and fighting.
Mad Max. It's Mad Max world.
Yeah. Yeah. So. She has a bit where she kind of shouts quite passionately about the Federation, about how great it is.
This so-called court should get down on its knees to what Starfleet is, what it represents.
And it reminded me a bit of Huxley in The Force Awakens when he gives his impassioned speech.
I remember you mentioned this guy. Who is this guy?
He's
the general.
He's the general
Huxley.
That's it.
Huxley.
I've named him Huxley because he's
Huxley. Oh, Huxley.
He's a bit more of a knockabout for
the
Huxley
kind of the red-headed bad guy.
Yeah, that's it. Hux, not Huxley. Why am I saying Huxley? I've softened him in my mind.
Aldous Huxley, the author, maybe.
No, it's not that. I'm not cultured enough to think of that.
Cliff Huxtable.
why not? But yeah.
Steve the Cosby Show.
Yes, he was.
Wow, we've done a lot of great 80s referencing in this episode. Which is fitting because we are talking about an episode that was made in the 80s. But yeah, there's some... yeah, some good overacting from Denise Crosby in that.
I think that scene would make a lot more sense if there'd been later stories that had really sort of delved into Tasha's background.
Yeah,
and given us a better clip. And you know, I think she was always done a massive disservice that they never really wrote her a good episode, and you know that's why she left.
I'd agree with that. Because you know, we get snippets of her character, and it seems like she could have been pretty interesting.
Yeah,
we just don't see anything else.
There's a parallel universe where there's a cracking good story written for her early in series one, and she carried on through all seven series of Next Gen and had some amazing storylines of it.
And Worf got downgraded to being an extra.
Yeah, probably.
Maybe.
Yeah. So, Swington roundabouts. Eh?
So at the end of that trial, that's the point at which they negotiate this kind of period where they get to go to, they essentially complete their mission and use that as the to be judged on.
And Q says something mysterious like,
"Your immediate destination offers far more challenge than you can possibly imagine. Yes, this far point station will be an excellent test."
I'll dub in Q's voice. That's what he actually said rather than the meaning.
That sounds about right.
Yeah. And but it just made me chuckle.
Otherwise, the script wouldn't work.
But it's funny that Q's making such a big deal about what they're about to encounter. What they encounter is like a fairly run of the mill, like reasonably forgettable sort of TNG story. Then we get to Farpoint Station and we meet some of the other. Crew members.
Yeah, we meet Riker.
Yeah,
and the
Crushers.
And then Geordi.
Yeah, and we don't spend a whole lot of time with Geordi, but we get a little bit of a sense of his character. They introduce the whole concept of his visor.
Yeah,
quite nicely.
They build that up in a good scene in sickbay when he sort of has a conversation with Dr. Crusher about it, and that's quite a good one because that gets it all there.
Yeah, definitely.
Basics. And he's later on the away team as Riker says he wants his eyes. But yeah, ultimately, Geordi has not a huge amount to do through the course of this episode.
But I'd say that the story does a reasonable job of introducing him. Not a brilliant job.
No.
There's enough about him where you think he's a main character.
We
get a fair bit about Wesley Crusher.
Big old jumper.
Massive jumper. It's like he's been out at sea. Freezing.
This is a kid from Stand By Me, so we need to make him look not like that kid.
Yeah.
And give him a massive jumper.
What did he wear in Stand By Me? A t-shirt.
T-shirt and shorts.
Find me the biggest jumper in town. An adult jumper.
Yeah.
For a child.
I'm a little disappointed, though, when Dr. Crusher tries to bring Wesley onto the bridge later, that we don't see Riker like diving in going, "No! Must protect Captain from meeting children."
Yes,
and this is there's some interesting stuff when Riker and Picard meet, and it's very different to how their relationship generally is going forward. I think they meet for the first time on the battle bridge, because the Enterprise D, the star drive and the saucer have separated in an attempt to run away from Q.
That's right, in a scene that is really dramatic, but it doesn't. It's not really.
But I think they included that so that they could have that set ready for future episodes. In your pilot, you want to use you want to create all the sets you're going to use for the show in the pilot, because then you have them. You don't have to go and create them later on.
So you can spend the money.
So I think that's why they use the battle bridge set. I don't mind that.
I think they also intended to have saucer separation be a bit more regular, a bit more of a frequent occurrence. And ultimately, it didn't pan out like that.
To my mind, I don't think they do it again till... Is it like end of season 6, beginning of season 7? Two-parter. The Borg.
They do it later in series 1.
When
Geordi takes command. And then they do it again at end of series 3 for Best of Both. Start of series 4 for Best of Both.
Of course they do.
And that's it till Generations.
Okay.
So
not often.
So Riker,
Asking for Freedom. Sorry, is the episode where they
So Riker and Picard meet for the first time on the battle bridge, and it's kind of Picard doesn't even look at him.
Right. It's weird. It's really
and
weird.
I guess that it must be that they had this idea of what Picard was going to be like. Like he wasn't going to be. I guess they maybe wanted him to be as far removed from Kirk as you can imagine. They wanted this show to perhaps be different, and they didn't. And initially, they thought, how about we have it where it's not the kind of, you know, the Kirk, Spock, McCoy thing. We don't have that. But it's a different ship. It's a different story. And I don't mind it. It's noticeably different, because not too long afterwards, even in the episode, they were a bit different.
I think it's a really misjudged scene, because it doesn't paint Picard in a particularly good light. He seems really unlikable and cold.
I guess that's not so bad, but you have to commit to that. You can't.
Yeah.
It seems like they lost confidence in that.
Got the sense that Patrick Stewart wanted to bring a bit more warmth to the captain, and the script and the direction was that he had to be a cold, hard ass. But he didn't really see the character like that. So it feels like there's a bit of conflict there in the way it's performed and the way.
I don't know if they were thinking of when. Well, initially he's quite cold and standoffish with Riker, but then he's going to open up and tell him his terrible trauma, his terrible secret. He's not great with children.
That he hates children.
This scene, there's a great scene.
I'll
deliver the dialogue, and then you can put the real dialogue in if you want.
Right, yes, I think I will do. I think I will.
So he says,
"Special favour."
"Anything, sir?"
"Using the same strength you showed with Captain DeSoto, I would appreciate it if you could keep me from making an ass of myself with children."
"Sir?"
"I'm not a family man, Riker, and yet Starfleet has given me a ship with children aboard."
"Yes, sir."
"And I don't feel comfortable with children." "But since a captain needs an image of geniality, you're to see, that's what I project."
"Riker, I've been on a list. I'm not going to beat about the bush. Been on a list,
but no one
must know about it."
"But the list is named after a bush." if you get
it's, it's weird. It feels like Picard is telling Riker about a like sinister secret about how he feels about children. And then he's putting it on Riker, to saying it's basically Riker's problem. Riker's got to make sure that no one else finds out about
it. Wouldn't work with any other kind of bracket of society. It's like a personal favour. I appreciate if you could prevent me from making an ass of myself with Lieutenant LaForge. I'm not a fan of hip hop or jazz music.
And I hate blind people.
I really hate blind people.
Bloody blindies.
You know, I don't have a problem, but I just don't want to be around them. You understand.
But it is an odd idea. I can't imagine who, at what point in the sort of script meetings, someone said, this is a great idea for the captain. Let's make him have a real problem with children. Did no one say, that doesn't seem like a very endearing characteristic for the character that we want to be, you know, to be the sort of hero of the show? I don't know, were people kind of asleep when that idea went by? And it's just so odd.
I'm wondering if there's a couple of guys in the writers' room going, well, that opens up a wealth of story opportunities.
Oh yeah, like a Home Alone episode.
Yeah.
where this kid's just kind of setting up traps for Captain Picard.
Yeah, maybe Wesley's.
In fairness, although it does take till series 5, we get Disaster, where he's trapped in the turbo lift with 3 kids, and that is a brilliant episode.
Yeah, I love that episode.
So, there was an element.
And Rascals as well, where he
becomes the thing he hates most.
Giles.
Yeah.
Because I guess what they were going for is the idea that they wanted to introduce the idea that there were families on a Galaxy class starship, and that was something that Picard wasn't comfortable with. Which begs the question, why did he go for the job? Because surely, it's the flagship.
You go where they send you.
Yeah, but
it's a flagship as well.
Yeah, I mean, it's a galaxy class ship.
So surely there's going to be a lot of people who want that. Who want that role? Why give it to the guy who hates children? Unless he's always had an officer that he can deliver that speech to make sure that it's kept under wraps.
Is this how Wesley's father was killed?
Ah, maybe he learned.
It's killed by a rampaging group of children.
Oh right,
blocking them from the captain, and they stampeded over him.
Maybe Picard saw that awful episode of the original series where they go to that planet that's populated by children.
Oh, Miri.
Yeah, and maybe he was just scarred by that.
Or maybe again, that's how Jack Crusher died. He hates children because he saw his best friend bonked on the head.
To be fair, in Encounter at Farpoint, they watch Encounter at Farpoint.
Yeah, that's right.
I was going to bring that up. It's the bizarre bit where Riker's brought up to speed by watching a very brief clip show.
Just happened to have cameras where the action happens. I never got that. But they did that. They did that as well in that episode in season 1 of the original series with our menagerie.
Oh yes, but that's explained because it's not actually cameras, is it? It's the Talosians sending that image through. But what I also like is you bring Riker up to speed, so he watches a very brief clip show. There's none of the court, none of the trial bit, yet he still seems up to date on everything.
Yeah,
they've missed out a fairly large chunk of it.
I think he was just pretending to understand what was going on. It's like the audience basically had to.
Yes,
because it's been pretty batshit crazy up to that point.
Yeah. So other moments were there? Should we talk about the McCoy moment?
Because that's actually a really nice
moment.
Definitely.
I loved that. I thought it was really, really nice.
It was a really sweet send-off, and it was this sort of thing, a handover thing.
I couldn't get over the fact that McCoy's legs look really thin in that sequence.
Old man legs get that way, man.
Yeah, I guess so. I mean, he does look pretty frail. I mean, he's playing it frail because he's playing it about 50 years older than he was at the time.
But he's about 70 there, isn't he? Maybe a bit older?
I honestly don't know.
Well, it was filmed before they did Star Trek 6, wasn't it?
It was filmed before they did Star Trek 5.
Oh, was it?
Because 5 was filmed during Series 2 of Next Gen.
Right, okay.
Yeah, they used some of the sets from Next Gen in Star Trek V. Yeah,
they didn't even bother disguising them a lot of times.
Yeah.
And ironically, some of the sets from Next Gen were from an earlier version, from the motion picture, I think.
Mm. Right, yeah.
I think there is an episode in Next Gen Series 2 where Worf's going through this Age of Ascension ceremony on the holodeck, and basically the simulation is a whole bunch... Two rows of Klingons are jabbing him with pain sticks.
Oh, yeah.
And apparently they had a major problem with boots for Klingons because they were using them all over on Star Trek V. Right. Klingons on there.
It makes it sound like they're on a real shoestring budget. Oh. If you'll pardon the pun.
That's really good. Not
thanks. Oh, come on, pardon it.
But anyway, yes, it was a beautiful moment. It was really nice.
But you know, it has absolutely no bearing on the story.
Completely irrelevant.
You could lose that scene and you'd lose nothing. And yet, it's probably my favourite scene in Encounter of Half-Life.
I think you might be right. I did get anything. Lovely. I'm like, wait a minute. Has Dr. McCoy been on the Enterprise all the time? This crazy Q stuff's been going on.
Yeah, yeah.
Because he's being transferred to the Hood, isn't he?
Mm. And what did he think of that? I get maybe he was just asleep. He was pretty old.
But yes, it is great. And I think
it was a good touch to have him paired up with Data as well.
I was about to say that. That's of all the characters to pair up with, Data's probably the best one.
Mm. I like that he really exaggerates his sort of southern accent.
What's going on, boy?
Because I'm old now.
I don't care anymore. Yeah. So that worked though. I thought that was a good idea. Yeah, I fully bought that he was really old in that scene because he was actually fairly old in that scene. He wasn't 137, but still. But yeah, it's really good stuff.
Mm.
It's. I felt while watching it that I don't know if there was something up with the editing or just the fact that so much of it was written on the fly, but I just felt like it was a bit choppy and a lot of the scenes almost seemed unrelated to each other, and I just sort of felt a little disconnect certainly as it went on.
The Farpoint story would have been better served if it had been that. For a story that it's not a bad story but it's not amazingly interesting, it loses something because it's being used as well as part of this larger story.
Yeah, and I think you're constantly thinking, well, when's that? Well, that Q guy showed up in the first half an hour. When's he going to show up again? What bearing does this have?
Yeah, I don't really care about Gruffler Zorn.
He seems to get quite a few scenes where he just gets to be nutty in his little office.
He's shouting at the walls.
Yeah.
Essentially, until you realise that actually the whole station is a life form they've enslaved. Spoiler alert, sorry.
Oh, Rick.
If you haven't seen this.
I guess it's been
you've had 30 years, yeah, what are you doing? Yeah.
They found this life form on this planet. They fed it a bit, but then they worked out what it can do, and then they
fed it enough to keep it alive, but kept it.
I didn't mind that. I kind of couldn't because they're essentially there to kind of look at to review this station as a potential trading post. Mm. I think.
Yeah.
I was like, well, it's all right. It's not great. Yeah. There's like a ghost town outside, and that's a bit weird, right?
Yeah.
Why is there a ghost town?
City, what happens? Literally look like a bunch of wooden shacks.
Yeah. So it's all right, but there's a ghost town. Things keep turning. You think about something, and it turns up.
That's oddly convenient. It's nice. But it'd be good to explain why that's happening, I guess.
But I didn't mind it. Like I thought it was. I liked. It's a relatively interesting story. There was never a point when I was watching Encounter at Farpoint where I lost interest. It was there was always something going on and coalescing into one kind of thing that made sense together rather than two separate stories that had maybe been smushed together a bit.
Because I think the pace that we talked about, and it kept up the whole way through. It really moves, and that kind of to me makes it a little more jarring where scenes don't really have a proper connection as they flow through.
Yeah.
But yeah, I mean, it moves along lots. It's an exciting introduction. to it. And, it covers all the basic stuff. You know, here's a new group. We've got, we've got the robot, the Klingon, the telepath, the tough-as-nails security officer. We've got the captain. We've got the first officer. We've got them all here. We've got the ship that's a luxury cruise liner, or a spa resort or something flying in space. So it sets up all the stuff we need. But,
it feels like it's adequate. It is absolutely fine, but it's not really very good.
I think when you look at All Good Things, that really enhances Encounter at Farpoint.
I agree with that.
It gives Encounter at Farpoint a whole new level of meaning.
Yeah. So definitely the very last scene in All Good Things where Picard finally joins the crew's poker game.
Yes.
Is all the more poignant if you've just watched Encounter at Farpoint and you see that character struggling to connect with people and being awkward with children and all that stuff. Like, actually, that suddenly you feel like, okay, that character has really grown and changed, and he's kind of a bit of a lonely character in Encounter at Farpoint.
And I think that's why the scenes in All Good Things, when he's seeing people and he's had 7 years of now how he relates to them, but they don't know him, and so that's kind of that's why that particular timeline is very effective, I think. That would be a really good thing to do, is literally watch Encounter at Farpoint and All Good Things together in one setting.
I think it'd be a great,
it'd be quite eye opening.
Just cut out 7 seasons of
of actual real awesomeness.
Yes,
I think the actors get a bit more comfortable in their roles over the course of Encounter at Farpoint as well. I got that sense a little bit.
Okay, I thought you were going to say over the course of the subsequent seasons.
Oh yeah, but, well, that as well. But in general, the is only really early on in Encounter at Farpoint where you notice that the way they're acting is pretty different to how you remember them.
Yeah.
Over the course of the season, but by the end of Encounter at Farpoint, the ending of that is pretty reminiscent of how TNG would be going forward.
Yeah, I'd agree with that.
Then talking about the next mission and something like that. There's a kind of a return to a sense of optimism and the crew being comfortable with each other and things like that. It definitely was an episode where it kind of, I generally got the sense that they settled into their roles as the episode progressed.
Right. There's some stuff I really liked with Crusher and Picard, actually, talking about their characters, the stuff they established with Picard and Wesley's dad. And that whole thing where there might just be something between Picard and Crusher. Like, I actually really liked the way that was played. It felt like the actors really made the most of that scene as well.
I liked the way that Picard was going in there and he was trying to, be nice and make this kind offer. And she totally knew what he was trying to do, and she completely, held him up to the most awkward moment he could have in that situation, because she was totally in control of it. She's like, oh, I requested this, why would I want to go? And he's like, but and actually, he was being a bit of a jerk, assuming there'd be a problem. She's a professional, she's an officer, she's a bloody good doctor, why would she want to leave? So it's kind of like a bit of a harsh thing that he was doing, really, making that sense. So I'm glad she held him up to some awkwardness for that.
It's been bullshit chivalry, isn't it, I guess?
Yeah. He's trying to be chivalrous about a problem that he's invented in his own head.
Yeah.
Exactly.
So. Plus, he wouldn't be too fussed if Wesley was off the ship with her as well, because of how he hates children so much.
And I don't feel comfortable with children.
But I love women.
There's a really uncomfortable scene where Wesley comes on the bridge and he freaks out and he loses it a bit with, because he sort of invites Wesley onto the bridge, and Wesley's like, oh, this is amazing, oh, I can't believe I'm on the bridge. And there's a proximity alert, and Wesley quite rightly says, it's a proximity alert, and Picard's like, get off my chair, get off my bridge, bunch of arseholes. It's like, whoa, calm down, mate. chill out. And then a bit afterwards, he's a bit like, oh, like you can kind of see in his face that he feels like he's overreacted a bit there, which he obviously has.
Usually.
Again, like not an endearing scene in a pilot for your new captain. But hey, that's what they went with. I don't understand that decision, why they decided that would be a great scene to have, but there it is.
Luckily, I don't think it was very many episodes in before the much better side of Picard came out.
Yeah.
Lost that sort of... I think actually he sort of found his feet quite quickly, really, thinking about Series 1 as a whole. So and then where he went from there. But it's some very odd decisions in that.
Definitely, because Picard's a character I absolutely love. I mean, he's my favourite character in Next Gen. He's probably my favourite Star Trek character ever. He's my favourite captain, and to see him in Encounter at Farpoint being all weird, it's hard to deal with.
Yeah, you kind of forget what it was like, then you go back and you're just like, whoa,
yeah,
that's interesting.
But one other thing that we haven't mentioned, actually, I thought that the Enterprise looked great. I didn't think that Farpoint Station looked all that great. There's a few shots where it's just so obviously a model shot. And when this kind of deserted city is being attacked by the entity in space, it looks very Thunderbirds. Don't get me wrong, I absolutely love Thunderbirds. I think Thunderbirds is great, and they did brilliant work with the model work on Thunderbirds. But it doesn't look right on Star Trek The Next Generation.
No, that's a certain thing, isn't it? It's like when you're watching Thunderbirds, you're watching puppets, flying models, airplanes and stuff. Then yes, you expect a certain amount of model looking because that's the whole style of the show.
Yeah.
When you see Thunderbirds model cities in Star Trek, it's less impressive.
I always liked it in Thunderbirds when there'd be a scene where some people were trapped and they'd be sweating. I thought, how did they get the little puppets to sweat?
Oh, someone's hailing.
So,
sorry,
so clever.
Very unprofessional when my phone was on.
Yeah. Oh, we need to save it for the Thunderbirds podcast.
Ah.
And even as I joke about that, bloody love to do a Thunderbirds podcast.
I love Thunderbirds.
Thunderbirds is brilliant.
Looks like you guys are coming up with our next podcast there.
Better believe it, buddy.
I noticed that Cole Meany is in. I forgot. I didn't.
I'm thinking,
is he O'Brien or is he just kind of like a con officer?
He's O'Brien because in All Good Things he's definitively O'Brien in the red uniform. So yes, absolutely, he is O'Brien, and that makes O'Brien to be. That means he's in the Next Gen pilot and finale, and the DS9 pilot and finale.
I think he. I'm sure I did a bit of investigation into who's been in the most number of Star Trek episodes a while ago, because I had that. It was a trivia question of my own thinking.
Is it Worf?
I think it is Worf, and then I think O'Brien's second in that. I think, but yeah, I wouldn't have thought it would be Worf because he only joins DS9 in the fourth season.
But that's still fourth, fifth, sixth. Seven. That's still 4 years of Deep Space Nine plus seven of Next Gen,
and I guess
plus the Next Gen movies.
Yeah, and O'Brien, I guess, probably wasn't in every episode of Next Gen, was he?
No, he was sort of guesting.
Rick, you're totally being hailed.
I am, yes.
What do you reckon, guys? It feels like we've covered everything, really.
I think yes.
Encounter at Farpoint.
We've thoroughly examined Encounter at Farpoint.
Yeah.
Beyond which lies the great unexplored mass of seven more years of Next Generation.
Yeah. There's one thing. There's one thing I forgot to mention. And it's absolutely essential I mention it. I actually thought Troy was pretty good in this episode.
Yes,
because
she used to be like a number one early on.
Yeah, and she actually gets to do her power is actually really useful because she can sense the emotions of well, apart from that bit, I don't mean her powers of stating the bleeding obvious.
They remain unabashed.
Yeah.
The whole seven seasons.
That after this, they deliberately toned down her powers because they felt some of her dialogue about feeling pain was a bit cringeworthy.
Yeah.
I also read a tweet from Marina Sirtis the other day saying she was glad that they didn't fire her because of how bad her performance was. Now, I take issue with probably both of those statements. Yeah. Because, yeah, some of the pain thing was a bit cringeworthy, but, like you say, I think that power, maybe she had a lot more to do going on with that. She had a lot more in that pilot to do.
Right.
And she had pretty much until the time she got kidnapped and made up as a Romulan.
Yeah.
And actually, for some of the poor dialogue and stuff and the very sort of choppy writing in there, Maureen Sirtis did a bloody brilliant job.
Do you know, I actually wrote, because I didn't know about that, but I'd actually written down in my notes that she actually does really well with the that whole stuff.
I thought that too. I noticed that as well. I think Picard and Troy really worked well together in this.
Yeah.
Like she definitely has that kind of like right hand person vibe about her. Like that's who Picard talks to the most in that early part of Encounter at Farpoint.
And the bits where she has to go, oh, pain, terrible pain. They could have come off as ridiculous and cheesy. But I actually thought she did a pretty good job of portraying the emotion of pain.
Yeah.
And there's a bit where she has to act kind of relieved, I think, later on. She
when the big old space jellyfish hold hands, she's very happy.
Yes.
But that's fine.
Yes,
it's nice.
Satisfaction, I think she says. But it's a pretty
hokey. Satisfaction, I think, was when they were torturing Groplazorn.
Right, that's it.
Yeah. Happiness and love was when the jellyfish were holding hands.
Yeah.
A feeling of great joy and gratitude.
But yeah, I think she's really good in the encounter. She deals with a lot of fairly ridiculous scenes.
I like that
really
she had
well.
A uniform as well.
Yeah,
that was you don't see her in uniform.
It's quite she'd been nude. That would have been very distracting.
But she,
well, at least it wasn't one of those jumpsuits things that she was wearing.
Yeah, it was a short uniform.
It was. I
see some dudes in that. I think they're called skirts.
Scants, yeah. I'm a fan of the scants. I think they're brilliant. And I really actually like that they were unisex. I wish they'd kept that going and just had random dudes walking around in them all the time.
Yeah, it's good to. Good for your junk.
If you were cosplaying, that'd be a very comfortable.
Be good for your junk?
Yeah. Well, if you're a more robust gentleman, that's the perfect outfit, isn't it?
We did.
But what do you mean by robust?
I mean if you need to let everything hang out a little bit, you don't want a tight fitting uniform. You want a nice, flowing dress,
a moo-moo.
Like the episode of The Simpsons where
we did encounter a guy at Destination Trek last year who had got a scant on. Niall got a picture with him actually because he thought it was so cool.
Oh, brilliant!
Big bearded bloke as well. He was like,
was it at the bar? Because then it could be encounter at bar point.
No, it wasn't.
No, that's good. Yeah, that's good.
But yeah, I was like, I just thought they were cool. I wish they'd kept that up. They'd sort of abandoned them quite quickly.
Yeah, it's kind of a shame because I liked that idea, but maybe they thought it was just a bit.
I think in that last scene on the bridge, actually, Yar's wearing one as well.
She is.
Mm-hmm.
We should point out, actually, at this point, that Niall is Rick's imaginary friend.
Yes.
And your imaginary friend now.
Yeah, I actually met him in my mind.
There's no shared hallucination.
Because I took my kids to Rick's kids' party a couple of weeks ago, and I did meet Niall. But I assume I met him in my mind because he is 100% fictional.
And I still haven't met him.
No. Well, he's not real, so never will.
You may one day share the hallucination with the rest of us.
Unless you get mad, basically.
Right, okay.
Which me and Rick have.
Yeah.
I think that's it. I think we've nailed Encounter at a Far Point. We've got a lot of other podcasts to do this evening.
Yes.
Let's do them.
Yeah, thank you so much.
It's weird.
I'm going to be honest, I think we're strong on the conversation, weak on the finish.
Yeah, we don't.
That's a great t-shirt
goodbye
slogan.
Strong on the conversation, weak on the finish.
Yeah, thank you so much for listening, and we'll see you next time. Until then, take care, and bye-bye.
And let's see what's out there.
Oh, I like it. Bye. Love you. Bye. Yeah, there's that again. I always say that. It's weird.
Some problem, Riker?
Just hoping this isn't the usual way our missions will go, sir.
Oh, no, Number One. I'm sure most will be much more interesting.
I don't feel comfortable with children.
Thank you so much for listening to our podcast. If you want to get in touch with us, our website is www.lowerdecksradio.co.uk. You can reach us on the Twitters at 10backward, 10 being the numbers 10 and backward being the word backward. We're also on Facebook at facebook.com/10backwardpodcast. And you can also email us at crew@lowerdecksradio.co.uk. On a personal individual level, my Twitter is @nerdrick, and I believe you two also have Twitters.
I do. Mine is @WillTurland.
Mine is @MrImhotep. MrImhotep.
So please do get in touch, give us any feedback or suggest new episode topics, anything like that.
Let's make sure that history never forgets the name.
10 backward?
Laddie, don't you think you should rephrase that?
10 backward. 10 backward.
Let's see what's out there. Engage.